The following program is being broadcast on the Amazing Women of Power, the world's leading positive programming network, powered by Raven International. This show contains motivational language and may not be suitable for negative listeners.
My dreams. I've had enough of these annoying and distracting schemes. I'll choose my friends because apparently they're choosing me. The time is now to pay attention to my destiny.
From his humble studio in Orange County, California, comes a young songwriter with a dream, encouraging others to go after their dreams. Learning from the best in the business and passing it along to you, it's Strong Rider on the radio.
I had the blues, but I made it better, baby. And that's why I wrote this song. And now you can sing along.
My mind's made up to listen and to learn from an iconic, prolific, and brilliant songwriter of the 20th century, and a man who is still going strong in this century. I want to get you into part two of this wonderful conversation that I had with Richard M. Sherman. Let me introduce myself first. My name is Dean Olson. I am the Strong Writer on the radio, and my goal is to help songwriters and artists keep musically fit. The way I love to do that is through faith and encouragement. And Richard M. Sherman is very encouraging, as you may have listened to in our previous episode. He needs no introduction, but to Disney fans all over the world, he is iconic and just as a stratospheric celebrity as Walt Disney himself. He was Walt Disney's right-hand songwriter along with his brother Robert. His late brother Robert passed away in 2012. They formed the Sherman Brothers songwriting team that dominated his parade of motion pictures in the 60s. There is so much more to talk about, so let's get right back into it. Let's listen and learn from Mr. Richard Sherman. Talk to you soon. Richard Sherman is back with me. He's agreed to continue to talk some more. You gave me quite a mouthful. You gave me the story on Smash Flops, which is this this reissue of an album that you and Milt Larson worked on in the in the 50s. Fantastic.
Oh, 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s. We've been contributing to it for years. And this brand new edition has brand new songs that are just written this year. So we have Smash Flops is really a compendium of a half century of comedy. Yeah,
that's pretty cool to know that you worked. You know, a lot of people know you solely from working with your brother Robert.
Of course.
And I understand that was kind of a complicated relationship. I don't know how much I can talk about.
No, it's not. That's an exaggeration. It was not a complicated relationship. Oh. We loved each other. We cared about each other. We just were different people. Bob was introverted. I was extroverted. So I was more of a showman. And it just worked like that. But basically, we were very much together on all these things. And we worked very hard together and spent half a century writing together.
And you were very good. I mean, there has to be something said for, the chemistry. Unless it's something you had to work at to be so good together.
Well, no, I think part of it is the fact that we came from different directions to write the same subject. And so we'd have a real plurality of concepts, and we'd learned how to mix them together and make it work. It was just, it's as simple as that. I know when we were trying to dig an idea for Poppins, I remember we wanted to come up with a theme for Mary Poppins and to say her philosophy in a simple way, and yet it's like a saying. And Bob, and this is verbatim, Bob came up with this marvelous idea. His kid came home from school, and Bob said, "What did you do?" And he said, "I had the salt vaccine today." He said, "Did it hurt?" He said, "Oh, no, they put the medicine on a cube of sugar, and we just took it down like candy. It was easy." And he came in the next day with this great expression on his face. He says, I think I've got the title. I said, "What is it?" He said, "Now listen to the wordage here. A spoonful of sugar makes the medicine go down." And I said, "That's, God, it's great. It's got alliteration, makes the medicine go down, everything." And then I thought about it for a while. I said, "You know, that's a great idea. It's very original, very different." But makes is not, it forces the medicine. Makes the medicine go down. No, it helps the medicine go down. And I was, yeah. So you see, what I did is I softened Bob's concept. He had a brilliant concept, and I softened it. And that made the Sherman Brothers. That's one of our keynote songs. But it's both of our brains working on the same subject.
Oh, wow. I've heard of that happening a lot when people collaborate. You know, you
switch one word.
Switch one word, and it can make a big, big difference.
Yeah. I know. My dad wrote a great big hit back in the 20s. It was called Me Too. Ho, ho, ha, ha, Me Too. And he was working with this fellow, and they were writing this song. And the song went, I don't care, I don't mind. Anywhere that she goes, you'll find me too, me too, me too. And it was just a cute idea, and the title was good. And a very terrific lyricist was listening to the song, and he said, Al, I'll tell you something. You got a pretty good song here, but me too, me too, me too, it doesn't work. He said, say ho, ho, ha, ha, me too. My God, right, you're absolutely right. That's absolutely right. It's a three-way song. They put Harry Wood's name on the song because he came up with me, the ho, ho, ha, ha. But that was the magic that made the song happen.
Wow.
So every songwriter should learn that it's every single word that makes it work. You know, there's always these legends, these stories about how a song gets written and everything.
Mm-hmm.
What was it? Berlin wrote a song called, I forget the title.
You have a lot to choose from. He wrote a ton of stuff.
He wrote everything. I know, but there's one song he wrote. Now I'm not remembering, but he couldn't come up with that last line of the song.
Uh-huh.
And I forget what it was. All alone. I'm so all alone. Just a raining fair ring, a ting-a-ling. All alone, I get lonely. All alone, I feel blue. And he couldn't finish the song. And in one day, about a year and a half, 2 years after he almost got the song, he said, wondering how you are and where you are.
Wow.
And if you are. All alone, too. Now, if you're a good songwriter, you got to get chills when you hear that line.
Absolutely.
Because it's absolutely goddamn marvelous.
So, when you and you personally are writing songs, have you ever gotten to a song where you can maybe get to two verses and a chorus, but you can't quite wrap it up?
You keep trying, but I've gotten pretty good at rapping.
Yeah?
I can wrap it up.
You can tie it up at the end like a package? Like a
yeah,
gift?
I tell you, the truth is that once I have a good idea, and the idea is the motivation for the whole thing, the craft is part of 60 years of writing songs with me. I can do it. It's just a matter of getting the angle, the thing that makes it fresh, so that you say the same damn thing, I love you, but you say it a new way. That's the whole idea, to say it a new way. Don't use the same old corny line.
Uh-huh.
And that's what it's all about. Everybody's written, I love you, I want you, I need you, I lost you, I'm sorry, forgive me. I mean, they've written all those subjects, but how do you say it specially? How do you say it differently?
Yeah.
That's what makes great songwriting. What would I be without you? But somebody wrote a line, you are the wind beneath my wings. That's a great title.
Yeah.
You see? That's a great title. That carries the whole song. There are songs that are written today that are marvelous once in a while. Most of the time, I can't even understand what they're singing.
So, this is great. I get off on a tangent here and there, but you kind of gave me the short story on how you grew up. You know, your father, and you said you came from a long list of songwriters, but what role did your mom play? Was she...
My mom was a very major role in the... She very encouraging. My mother was an actress and a wonderful pianist. She played beautifully on the piano. And she could interpret music beautifully. And she also was a very good judge of what was going on. And she would always encourage me. And I was so discouraged in the beginning. I just thought I'd never make it. I mean, I kept trying. And one day she slipped a little note under my door. I remember she didn't come in. And she said, you're going to make it. Have faith. Keep slugging. Keep trying. And I remember she just slipped it under my door one day because she knew I was feeling so kind of beaten. But, you know, it doesn't happen all the time. Everybody gets those terrible times, but you got to keep slugging away and trying. Don't throw the sponge in. Just stay in the fight.
Thanks. You could. I'd be fine with you just saying this over and over for the entire interview, because that's what's kind of all about. You get punched in the face. Don't shake it off like a...
You got to. I mean,
yeah. It's hard to, but you got to do it, right?
You know, think of what an actor goes through. At least a songwriter has his song. He has his piece of paper with his hen scratching on it. But an actor pours his life into interpreting a part, and all he has is the performance he does. and somebody looks at them and says, okay, leave your 8x10 glossy and we'll get back to you, or we won't, or something. And he leaves. And that's all he has, is his personality. He just stands in front of somebody in an audition. He doesn't even have anything to bring back with him. That's the toughest thing in the world. I think being an actor is the hardest, most possible thing to do to yourself. Unless you just have to do it. You know, I've always referred to my desire to be a songwriter. It was an itch I had to scratch. It was something I had to do. It's something that was absolutely overwhelming to me, because I couldn't imagine breathing without writing songs. That's what I had to do. And that's how much it meant to me. And that sounds kind of funny coming from a guy that's been around for a long, long time, but I still have that feeling. I still get panicked when it's a blank page and I have to write something. It's like I'm writing the first time around.
Even you.
I still get panicked about it.
Wow.
It's an empty page. So what am I going to put down this time? Oh my God, what am I going to say? And then once in a while something hits you and it's just overwhelming and you got to write it. And if you're good, you write it well.
Unbelievable.
I was in a meeting last year discussing the 60th anniversary of Disneyland.
Yeah.
And in the course of this discussion, we were talking about some of the songs Bob and I had written for the parks over the years, the Disney parks. And we were going to use a number of those things, which they do now, in the big ceremonies that they're doing all over the parks.
Yes.
And at one point, we were talking, and we were talking about the fireworks. And somebody had told me this story, that Walt Disney, when he was a kid, loved fireworks because he was a poor kid in the Midwest somewhere. Mm-hmm. And that was the big highlight on the 4th of July. He could see this fireworks show, and he just loved that. And when he was concluding the things he was going to do for Disneyland, the opening 60 years ago, he said, at the close of the night, when everybody's leaving, I want to give them, just before they leave the park, a gorgeous a fireworks show every night. And I want to have music playing. I want to have Tinkerbell flying across the sky. I want to have that. That's my little gift to them. It's my little kiss goodnight to the folks when they leave. Say, instead of saying thanks for coming, come again, give them that little kiss goodnight, that little extra something to light their lives. And I heard that story, and I heard this fella just using this word, kiss goodnight. I said, my God, that's a song title. That's a great, it's got to be written. And I wrote a song about Walt, and it was called A Kiss Goodnight. It doesn't say Walt, but it's all about he opened the doorway to people's imagination. And I wrote this song, and they went bananas for it. And now it concludes every night at the park. Every night they play this magnificent orchestra. The London Philharmonic plays it. Mm-hmm. And Ashley Brown, who played Mary Poppins, came out to record it. I was there with her, and she recorded it with this glorious voice of hers. And every single night, they're playing my latest song, which is called A Kiss Goodnight. And it was inspiration. It was inspiration. It was original. It was different. Nobody ever wrote about what Walt gave to the world, but I did. I wrote A Kiss Goodnight.
And you believed in that, so it was, once you started getting going, you probably...
It wrote itself.
It started writing itself.
It wrote itself.
You know what, Richard? I live about 5 minutes from the park. And every night, ever since we moved into our house, we hear those fireworks every night at about 9:30 or so.
That's right.
And it's fun, you know.
But now when you go to the park and you'll hear Ashley Brown singing A Kiss Goodnight, and you'll know what that's all about.
Wow. Yeah, now that we know the story, you probably could guess if you paid attention to the lyrics of the song that when you're saying that he... You know, gave us that's
no, but no, I don't say he.
Yeah. I thought you said he when he.
No,
did
no,
that.
No, no. Okay. He gave me the inspiration. I just wrote about what a kiss goodnight means.
Ah.
It's the doorway to imagination. It opens up your dreams. It opens up your ideas to things you never dreamed of. It's a very, very beautiful thing.
Oh, okay. And I was a little slow on the uptake. Sorry about
no,
that.
No. Yeah. No, it's not. I don't say he. What I meant is behind the song is the idea. But the song itself stands on its own. It's about a kiss goodnight, that's all.
I'm going to have to listen closely when this happens again.
So. Yeah. See, I said, kiss goodnight is a doorway to dreamland. That's the opening line of the song.
So you'll be at...
Kiss goodnight is where memories begin. And it just tells what it's all about.
Kiss goodnight.
you're going to be at Disneyland for the actual 60th anniversary day.
Yeah,
how many of these celebrations you've been a part of? This can't be the first, I'm sure.
Well, they've done a couple of things that I've been involved with. I did Small World, and I did Tiki Room, and I did a whole bunch of things for the park. So I'm involved in a tremendous amount of it, you know, the Winnie the Pooh ride and God knows what. So, whenever they have a 50th anniversary or something, I'm called out to, hey, we got to be part of this. Okay.
Were you and Robert there for when they opened the Tiki Room back in whatever it was, 60-something?
Well, actually, that was back in 1963, I believe it was.
Yeah.
It was the first audio animatronics show ever done. And it was a marvelous experience for people because they'd never seen the automatic birds singing and flowers, you know, moving and singing and everything. It was something very special for them. And it was kind of a thrill to do that. Little did we know that that would be the very first audio animatronic experience in the world. Subsequent to that, we did a tremendous amount of things for them. The Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow for Tomorrowland and all that. They're all part of our song.
Yeah, and some of these things have gone away. But that song, I can still hear it in my head, the Great Big Beautiful Tomorrow.
Oh, they use the melody for a Great Big World of Interventions, and that's the Interventions thing. But it's not as glorious as it was when you were on the ride, and the scene changed. You know, you were in this circular auditorium, and it was just a marvelous thing.
There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, shining at the end of every day. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, and tomorrow's just a dream away. Man has a dream, and that's the start. He follows his dream with mind and heart, and when it becomes a reality, it's a dream come true for you and me. So there's a great big beautiful tomorrow, shining at the end of every day. There's a great big beautiful tomorrow, just a dream away.
I want to keep this moving. You know, my wife, when she heard I was going to talk to you, she goes, oh, please, ask him this, ask him this, ask him this.
Ask away.
You talked about Mary Poppins. You know, they made that into a musical. So that was a big deal for you, I'm sure. When what inspired you to write new material, like new songs and music for it?
Well, in the case of Mary Poppins, I didn't write any new material. Two very talented English writers did.
Okay.
Because Mrs. Travers, who was a bit of a nutcase, didn't want to have any Americans touch her Mary Poppins again. So despite the fact that it was a world classic, she didn't want my brother and myself to write any new songs. So Stiles and Drew, two very talented guys, wrote
them. I see. Okay. And then, of course, a lot of people, the world's focused on that story when Saving Mr. Banks came out on the screen.
Yeah.
And how close to the truth was the portrayal of you two Sherman brothers on there? Was it
very
was
close to the truth? She was horrible.
You can say, you don't have to sugarcoat it. Don't worry.
I'm not sugarcoating it. She was a very difficult lady, and Walt couldn't stand her. He could absolutely not stand her. He had to put up with her because he wanted to do Mary Poppins.
He really wanted that,
And he loved our storyline because we came up with a storyline. She didn't have a story. I mean, the reason why it's called Saving Mr. Banks is because she created this fictional father in her stories, and then she started believing that's her father. But her father was a lush. He was a drunk, and he died when she was 8 years old, and he disappointed her terribly, and she was a sort of a warped character who decided to believing in her characters. And so when we had the father, a troubled man who paid more attention to his bank job than he did to his kids, that gave ourselves a story. So Mary Poppins comes in and straightens the family out, and then she flies out again. She hated us because we made Mr. Banks a problem. And that was the thing. I said, we need a story curve. We need a storyline. This is the storyline. The mother's busy with a cause. The father is busy with the bank. And Mary Poppins is needed. She comes in and does things. So at one point, I even said to her, Mrs. Travers, why does Mary Poppins come to the Banks family? She says, I don't explain anything. And neither does Mary Poppins. Well, come on. Is that the way you're going to do a movie? You can't do a movie like that. This is the kind of a woman she was. She was really warped.
Yeah. Okay. Good. I'm glad.
If anything, the picture sugarcoated her.
Really? Yeah, they had to make it palatable for you to watch, otherwise they'd probably be turned off.
Otherwise you would have walked out on her. Yeah.
But I'm always interested in hearing from the people, you know, straight from the, I don't want to say the horse, but the horse's
mouth. She had the gall to say to Walt Disney, whom I just think is one of the greatest men that ever walked, and she said, "I don't want to have any of your silly cartoons in my picture," she said. And, you know, Walt sort of just gulped. I remember he said, "Well, it's a live-action picture, Pamela. It's just we're going to have certain effects." Because he couldn't tell her we're going to have animated penguins. She couldn't understand the fact that he was doing something very special and special, new. He had a new kind of a screen that UB iWorks had created called the sodium vapor screen, where you actually could film live actors and put them into animated situations, right, and they look like they're in the situation.
Right.
And she couldn't understand it. And so she just said, "I will have no animation in my picture." So he lied to her and said, "No, it's going to be a live-action picture." And, of course, it was alive. But we had to do that.
Yeah.
We don't sugarcoat it.
Were you part of the, doing production of the film?
Oh, yeah, I was there every day.
Yeah. Were you just in a room with your brother trying to compose the stuff as the, you know, like when they put you in front of a screen to see the finished product? Or were you part of the whole thing on the set and...
Are you talking about the background score?
Yeah, like when you do the score.
No, we didn't do the background score. That was a brilliant man named Irwin Kostel.
Ah, okay.
Irwin Kostel wrote the score. Bob and I wrote the songs. And a lot of people don't understand that. No, we did not write the score.
I got you.
I did not underscore the picture.
You've done this before, but not in those films, yeah.
No, I basically, Bob and I are songwriters. We write music and lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we wrote dialogue leading in and out of our songs. But that's all. And many times we'd suggest, here's where you could use Feed the Birds under here when he walks to the bank. And we'd suggest it to the composer. And then we call him the composer, but he's actually the musical director. And he would write it that the way he felt it. And he would modulate the songs, and he would meld the songs and making them work into a film. And that's a whole art unto itself, background scoring. And it is not what a songwriter does, basically, no.
I see. Okay. But you've, in the past, you've worked alongside other ones. You worked with George Bruns and...
Absolutely not. Yeah. George Bruns, again, is the guy that we did Jungle Book with George Bruns. And Jungle Book has a lot of our themes in it. But George Bruns took those themes and wove them into the picture. That's not the same. He didn't just play the melodies. He worked with the tunes and he made them work.
Okay.
And that's how it was. I mean, he also wrote melodies on his own. He wrote a lot of stuff that added to the score, of course.
So you two are partitioned from these other, like the score composers and.
Well, we work with them. That's subsequent. Bob and I write the music before the picture is ever even conceived. Most of these pictures don't have anything.
Oh,
we come in with either a script writer gives us a script, and we sit there and figure out, break down where we're going to use a song, and we write the song, and then we adapt, and sometimes there's a whole bunch of dialogue which we've covered in our song, so we lob the dialogue out and say, he just says this and goes into the song. Basically, we wove the music, the songs, into the pictures. In the case of Mary Poppins, we actually wove the story into the songs because we were writing one song after another and then developing story as we went along. And that was a different situation. Most of the time, we write with a script in mind first.
So when you have a film like Mary Poppins, did you write almost everything before the thing got under?
80% of the song score was written before the script was written.
Including the ones that never made it into the film, like
yes,
the chimpanzee?
Yes, because you wrote a lot of things that were not used in the picture. And then when Bill Walsh, who finally wrote the script, when he finally took the storyline that Bob and I and Don DeGrotte wrote and wove a screenplay, which was brilliant, with all his brilliant dialogue and funny things, which he wrote, he added a run on the bank. And so we wrote this Fidelity Fiduciary Bank in order to establish that bank sequence. And we wrote that subsequent to it. When we were casting the picture, we were thinking about casting Glynis Johns in the role of Mrs. Banks.
Uh-huh.
And she said she wouldn't do the picture without a song. So over a weekend, Bob and I wrote Sister Suffragette, and we gave her an entrance song where she does that.
Nice.
I mean, we wrote songs subsequent, but the main key songs of the picture were all written prior to the script even being written. We had Feed the Birds, and we had Spoonful of Sugar, and we had Chim Chim Cheree, and we had all those songs long before the script was written. But we did have a storyline. And that's what I'm talking about. When you have a show, when you have exactly what you're going to do, and you know there's going to be a sequence here. We knew what to write, and we did a lot of sequences that were never used. We had a tremendous amount of writing we did for a sequence called the Magic Compass sequence, where they go all around the world. And no, we never used the sequence at all. Used one of the songs in a subsequent picture called The Beautiful Briny Sea. We used it in Bed Knobs and Broomsticks.
Oh,
that
yeah,
was a song
yeah.
that was actually written for Poppin'. So, you know, that's the way things are when you're at a studio and you can use your material that isn't used in one place, use it somewhere else.
That's great. Wow. Well, we've already gone over the composition of scores and everything like that, but have you ever, if you were composing something for the modern movie-going audience, what genre would you experiment with? Anything that...
It depends on the story.
Yeah, so you would take the story.
If the story is about a bunch of rappers who are sitting around a street corner, I'd most likely be writing a rap. But I'd prefer not to do that.
Yeah.
I'd prefer to write something that has more of a substantial musical base. If it's a 1935 story, I'll write the 1935 style. If it's a German story, I'll write a German style. If it's a French story, I'll write a French style.
Right, I got
I try to write what's called for in the story. The story is God. That's the key. Mm-hmm. I don't write the same type of thing for everything. A lot of writers don't have that facility, but I have a facility to do that. I can think French, I can think 1941 America, and I can write that kind of a style. I can do anything that's called for if the story is there, and the story is inspiring, then I'll write it.
That's a great talent to have.
Well, it's a gift. I don't take any bows for a gift. It's something I've got. I don't know how I can do it, but I do.
Yeah.
I love music. I've loved it ever since I was a little boy, and everything sort of sinks in with me with music. I've been called upon to write Japanese style. I've been called to write God knows what, and it comes. I can write 1885 Western American. I can write that. I can do hillbilly. I can do it, all that stuff. And I don't have any one style that I favor. I've written a tremendous amount, as you obviously know,
yes.
of English style, English music hall style. Because I love that style. I learned that with Milt Larson. His great collection of records is the thing that gave me a knowledge of the great singers and performers of the English music halls. And so therefore, when it came to writing Jolly Holiday and Supercalifragilistic mm-hmm. and Let's Go Fly a Kite, I knew exactly the kind of song to write.
That's great. So, yeah, I'm throwing out some of these other questions are redundant because you've answered it already. So, what did you like doing more, writing for those live action or fully animated, or did it make a difference?
No difference. No.
Yeah, same
story,
thing.
A good story is a good story. I just write the story is everything. The characters, the situation. That's what I write for.
Between the two of you, Robert and you, who composed or wrote the lion's share of the songs, or was it like a 50-50 give and take thing?
Well, Bob and I shared all the credits together, but actually I was a musician of the two of us, but Bob would have a lot of editorial things to say about the music and selection of the music, and we wrote lyrics together and ideas together, always.
That's a critical role that he has then.
He was my editor, in a sense, musically.
How do you become so prolific, to use an overused term? You know, like Irving Berlin would write like a couple songs a day. I mean, how do you just come up with that?
You know something? There's a thing called a given gift. And my brother Bob and I both had fertile minds and a gift for writing. And Bob applied his songwriting, his script writing, and his novel writing talents to songwriting. I was gifted with music and I was gifted with lyric writing. And we just put our songwriting and lyric writing and story ideas together. We just worked together as a team and we could almost finish each other's sentences.
Yeah.
Over the years, I mean, we just thought together, and many times I start an approach of a song. He said, "Oh no, we don't want to do that. We want to do this," and he'd sort of grunt something, and I'd, "Oh, I see what you mean." And I could sort of read him; he could read me, and then I'd set a pattern down, and then we'd start writing there, and we'd write actually together simultaneously. We'd come up with things, and he could finish a line that I'd started. I could finish a line that he started. It was just a very remarkable thing. I do that same thing with Milt. He is very fertile mind and very funny, and we spark each other, and that's the way it works.
Well, Well, I'm going to put down my my note cards and just tell you that how much I enjoy talking with you. You seem to enjoy talking as much about the music as you enjoy doing it, and I think that's great.
Well, it's my life work, and I've been doing it all my life. And if I encourage some apprentice new songwriters wanting to learn, mm-hmm. and if I prepare them for the fact that it's not easy, and for the fact that they have to look for the original wrinkle, that original twist, and the fact that they have to learn how to endure insults and injuries. If you can do all that and you still have that itch that you got to scratch, God bless you. Go for it.
That's great. Yeah, I warned you at the beginning that I want songwriters and artists to hear this and be inspired. Is there a little bit of wisdom you can tell somebody who might be struggling or getting close to saying that I'm throwing in the towel for a while, or, you know,
I think the thing is, if you don't keep trying, you're just a ripple on the sea of life. But if you keep trying, one day you'll hit that splash.
Excellent. And that's strictly on the record.
Okay.
I love it. Oh, thank you, Richard. I hate to say goodbye because, you know what? If you have anything to promote, like when you turn 100 or something like that, please call me back.
Okay, that's a date. I'll do that.
Okay. So you're going to be tomorrow. You're going to be over at the Magic Kingdom.
Yeah, tomorrow and the next day in the morning. I think it's at 10 o'clock in the morning. There's an official opening ceremony that I'll be part of. Ashley Brown is going to sing "Feed the Birds."
Oh, fantastic!
And I'm going to play for her.
Is this going to be a press fest? A lot of people taking pictures?
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of stuff there. Yeah.
How long?
Try to crash. Get into it.
I would love to, yeah. How do I get in and come up and say hi to you?
But believe me, I don't know how. I'm going to be involved in so much stuff that day. I can't tell you.
Yeah, it was nice.
Well, you take care now. You have a good day.
You too, and then have a great day tomorrow, okay?
Okay, thank you very much.
Take care. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
What a great man. Richard M. Sherman. You can tell I almost wanted to say have a great, big, beautiful tomorrow at the end there, but, you know, I want to thank him so much from the bottom of my heart, Richard Sherman, for delivering the inspirational element that I so strive for on this show, and for answering almost every question I had on my list. I wasn't able to get to everything, but when you have them for that long, you just don't want to overstay your welcome. So thank you again, Richard M. Sherman. Now, if you remember, in the first part we talked about his other songwriting partner, his best buddy, the great Milt Larson, who with Richard formed the songwriting team of Sherman and Larson. And they created this great compendium of songs called Smash Flops. I want you to go check them out at iTunes or Amazon. Just do a search for Sherman and Larson, Smash Flops. And we'll talk about that some more when I get to talk to Richard Sherman's friend, Milt Larson, who is a man about town here in Hollywood. He will be on the show as my very special guest next time. And you won't want to miss it because we talk some more about the great Richard Sherman behind his back. You're going to hear that and learn all the secrets. It's going to be great, and it was a pleasure to have Richard on the show. I got to get going. I really hope you enjoyed the show. Thanks for listening. My name is Dean Olson, the strong writer on the radio, saying, let's all put our best pens forward and be strong writers together. Go forth, have a wonderful weekend. God bless, and take care. We'll talk to you next time. Goodbye now.
You've been listening to Strong Writer on the Radio, with your host, Dean Olson, on the amazing Women and Men of Power, world's leading positive programming network powered by Raven International.